This episode of Metatrex is brought to you by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is Tim Russ, Lieutenant Commander Tuvok on Star Trek Voyager, and you're listening to Trek FM.
There's no greater challenge than the study of philosophy.
My philosophy is that there is room for all philosophies on this station.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to episode 43 of Metatrex, Trek FM show on Star Trek and philosophy. My name is Zachary Frueling, and with me today is Mike Morrison. Today, we'll be doing a philosophical character analysis of Jadzia and Ezri Dax. Mike, welcome to the show. How are you today? It's been a couple of weeks since we've had a chance to sit down and podcast together.
It's been a couple of weeks, but I have to say that I'm really cozy in this warm brown goo, this mud bath that we're in here. It's really nice, except once in a while I feel something slide by my leg. It's kind of creepy. I gotta be honest with you.
Well, like a lot of mud bath communication, most of the communication is nonverbal.
Yeah, there's no verbal communication in a mud bath. That's I think that's one of the rules of acquisition, actually.
No verbal communication in a mud bath. It actually sounds to me like that might be one of Robin Loeffler's laws.
If not, she should add it to the list.
Agreed. Well, Mike, you are the one who suggested talking about Dax today. We were trying to think of a topic for today's episode of Metatrex, and you were chomping at the bit to talk about Dax. Do you want to say a few words about why Dax has been on your mind?
Yes. If memory serves, it was Metatrex 37, Zachary, I believe, when we were talking Essential Philosophy from Season 7 of Deep Space Nine, and we both decided that it would be an interesting idea to discuss Dax. I think the thing that really draws my curiosity to this character more than any other factor is the idea of dual or shared consciousness. It's a really fascinating prospect to me. This idea that Benjamin Sisko says in the episode Invasive Procedures, once a Trill is joined, it's like a rebirth. And he said of Varad, he'll be an entirely different person. He said that he would no longer be just Varad anymore, but he would be a blending of Varad, Dax, and all the previous hosts. There's a sharing of all the previous hosts' memories, their knowledge, even personalities, and I think that's really fascinating. Now, I'm the amateur philosopher of the two of us, so I'm really hoping that you can shed some light on this from a philosophical perspective, because I've seen plenty of written information out there, plenty of stuff written about consciousness. I mean, Descartes, Locke, Searle, Chalmers, you know, even stuff on the philosophy of collective consciousness. But this is something that I think is really unique. I think that deserves some discussion. Symbiotic relationships and symbiotic existence are concepts that are really common in nature, certainly. But just when you think that Star Trek has explored all the most really interesting alien species out there in the galaxy, it gives us the Trill. And while we have Star Trek The Next Generation to thank for it, it's actually the character Dax, Jadzia Dax, Ezri Dax, that really gives us the best window into this really astonishing idea of a truly symbiotic life form.
You know, Mike, you and I have spent a lot of time here on Metatrex talking about consciousness in one way or another. And frankly, Star Trek seems to be obsessed with the notion of consciousness. You know, different characters, whether it's Vulcan, Katras, or whatnot. Different characters in Star Trek, you know, seem to embody consciousness in different ways. And certainly the writers and producers of Star Trek, I would say especially, Mike, in the 1990s with the influence of Brannon Braga, you get this influx philosophical concepts and ideas about centered around consciousness, other ideas in metaphysics too, but consciousness is one of the big themes of Star Trek throughout the 1990s. And I think that that comes to fruition to some degree with the character of Dax. But Mike, the thing I think I find most interesting about the Dax character is there's kind of this barrier of understanding. You know, I just don't have this ability to understand what a joint consciousness would be like. I have no real direct experience of that kind of thing. So, you know, I worry a little bit about how much we can conclude or how much, you know, philosophical material we can draw out of the Dax character, just given that fact. And before the show, I'd kind of prepared a short list of some of the different ways you might spell out the relationship between the host and a symbiont in the Trill species to see if we can learn anything at all. And I think it's one of these like stereotypical tools of the philosopher's trade. You know, when in doubt, you make a distinction and hope you can learn something from it. And that's exactly what I tried to do in thinking about the Dax character. So I do have kind of a short list of different ways of spelling out the relationship. But before we talk about that, I wanted to spend just a little time talking about the meaning of the term symbiont. I always thought this was a really interesting term. And, you know, I took Greek years and years ago when I was in college, and you have quite a bit more experience in Koine Greek than I have. So I wanted to do some Googling, like what are the roots of the term symbiont? And I was surprised to find there are three separate roots. These are things I probably knew, but I never really thought about it and the meaning of the term and what an interesting term it is. The three Greek words that, you know, come together to form the term symbiont are the term soon or together, bios or life, and ontos or being. And you put all those together and you get symbiont. And that's a really fascinating term. And I think the nature of that term itself, living together, being and living together. And that's exactly what you have in some way with the host and a symbiont in the Trill species. The philosophical question, of course, is what is the nature of that together relationship? You know, are they a single shared consciousness? Are they two and distinct separate consciousnesses? Is one more dominant than the other? And I think it's hard to really know, of course, because none of us have experienced this kind of consciousness. And I think you can see different ways in which our intuitions about that different relationship are drawn out in different episodes involving the Trill and involving Dax in particular. But, you know, again, I'm a little skeptical of whether we can learn anything terribly philosophically interesting, just given the fact that we don't really have any direct experience of this kind of consciousness, just based on what we see on screen in Star Trek. So given all of that, what's your take?
Yeah, Zachary, I think I can agree with that sentiment to some degree. But in the course of discussing Dax, I believe what we'll find is that we're going to be able to make more connections probably than what we even anticipate, because, again, this idea of a shared consciousness, this idea of two beings sharing a connection and existing not just as two beings, but really existing almost as one being. Is one more dominant than the other, or is it really a shared thing? In the case of Dax, we're talking about not just a host and a symbiont, but that symbiont retains the memories, the experiences, the characteristics of previous hosts. So all of that kind of comes into play here with this character. So at the end of the day, what you really have is a mesh, at least in the case of Dax, eight lifetimes, this incredible mesh of all of these people throughout the entire history of Dax, the symbiont creature.
I think that's a really good point. I think it's very easy to forget that the previous hosts seem to have some sort of long-lasting influence on the current symbiotic relationship. You know, we see several instances in Deep Space Nine of a previous Dax host, the personality of that host reemerging, you know, in the course of the episode, one way or another. You know, so, but I tried to kind of spell this out. So one option, I think, is just that the two consciousnesses form a single shared joint consciousness. So it's such that it wouldn't even make sense to say there are two different beings or two different consciousnesses. You know, and when I think of consciousness, I think of like centers of experience. Like I have my own center of experience. It's here in my own head, in my own brain. Mm-hmm. I've got all my sensory input, and you've got your head over there and your brain and all of your sensory input. And so it's really clear there are two different consciousnesses, two different centers of experience. And as I struggle to think of a definition of consciousness, it just seems like this self-awareness, the center of experience, is the best definition I can come up with for what consciousness means. So when you look at the Dax character, I think one of the most fundamental questions you can ask is, how many consciousnesses are there? Is there a single consciousness that is influenced by all the personalities of the different hosts and of the symbiont itself? Or are there multiple consciousnesses? Does the Dax symbiont retain its own conscious awareness, even though it's in a host and even though there's some shared experiences? Is that a different center of experience than the host center of experience in its own mind? Or are they so neurally fused at that point that it doesn't make sense to think of them as separate centers of awareness anymore?
Well, Zachary, we have a few options here to use as we kind of explore this character. Do you want to kind of break those down?
Well, yeah, I tried to spell this out before the show, and this is my shooting from the hip attempt to make sense of this. So the first two options on my list are the two that I just mentioned, that there's a single shared consciousness in some way. There's only one center of experience, and that the personality of that being is influenced by the separate personalities of all the components that were fused together to form this being, you know, previous host, the current host, and the symbiont. But when it comes to conscious awareness, there's only one center of awareness. So that's option one. Option two is that there are two, maybe more than two, if the previous host retains some sort of awareness. I'm not sure how that would play out, but at least two distinct and separate consciousnesses. So the host has its own center of awareness, its own self-awareness, and the symbiont would have its own consciousness, its own self-awareness. And I think it seems like you can find the problem that I have is it seems like you can find examples of both of these inside Deep Space Nine. Different episodes kind of pull the intuition different ways. Sometimes, like I'm thinking of the very beginning of Deep Space Nine, when Jadzia shows up and she says, "Don't worry, Benjamin, I'm still the same old Dax," mm-hmm. right? As if nothing has changed. Like there's like the Dax symbiont retains its own personality regardless of which host it's in. And that seems to give some credence to option number two. But the problem is I think you can find evidence for both of these. And they're not really compatible. It really seems like it's one or the other. Are there two centers of awareness, two beings that are conscious at any given point? You know, there's whatever the symbiont is thinking and feeling. There's whatever the host is thinking and feeling. If those are two different centers of experience, then we've got two different consciousnesses. So those are my first two options. Options three and options four, I don't think are really incompatible with either of the other two options. It would be sort of a nuance that you could place on top of either of those two options. Option three would be that the symbiont is the dominant consciousness, the dominant personality maybe. Option four would be that the host is the dominant personality or the dominant consciousness. And I think you could spell this out either way. I think if there's a single shared consciousness, such that there's only one center of experience, you could have a dominant personality. The symbiont mm-hmm. could be the dominant personality involved, even though there's only one consciousness. If there are two separate consciousnesses, then the symbiont could still be the dominant personality that emerges or manifests itself in the behavior of that symbiotic being that, you know, that we know as a Trill. Likewise, same thing with option number four. If the host is dominant, if there's only one consciousness, it could be that the host personality is the dominant personality and somehow the symbiont's personality gets suppressed or subdued or doesn't come to light as much as the host's. And same thing if there's two different consciousnesses, the symbiont or the host's personality could be the dominant personality that manifests itself in the behavior that we see externally. So I don't think of option three as four as being separate options in the sense of being mutually exclusive, but I think one and two, where you really have to choose between interpreting the Trill as a single consciousness or multiple consciousnesses. I don't think those are compatible with each other. You seem to really have to, at the end of the day, it has to be one or the other, given the way we've defined the terms. But in terms of personality, in which personality is dominant, option three or four would be compatible with either of the other two. That's kind of the lay of the land as I saw it coming into the show today.
Yeah, the thing that's really fascinating to me here is that at the end of the day, I think that to some degree, my intuition is going to be more a mesh, if you will, of option two, which is that you have two distinct and separate consciousnesses, and option three and four, in which, you know, either the symbiont is dominant, option three, or option four, the host is dominant. And I say that because, again, depending on what episode you're watching, they tend to pull those intuitions one way or the other. So I think if you were to sit down and binge watch a Dax-centric kind of rundown of shows, and I have some Dax episodes, some essential Dax that I'll share towards the end of the podcast today. So if you're taking notes and you really want to just kind of jot down, I've got at least what I think, in my opinion, is a essential Dax for our listeners. But if you were to sit down and watch all of these all at one time, I think your intuitions would get pulled one way or another. And what you would find is that at the end of your binge watch, what you really come up with is this idea that these are two distinct and separate consciousnesses in which, depending on the situation, one or the other may have some dominance. I think the idea that they are a single shared consciousness, I disagree with that, in that there are times in which Jadzia especially comments on the thoughts or feelings of her symbiote. She's almost characterizing something separate within her. And so I think this idea that they're a single shared consciousness, I think we can kind of almost dismiss that, set it aside. But the thing, again, that I find interesting is we're not just talking about Dax and Jadzia or Dax and Ezri, but Dax brings with it, and we don't know whether it's a he or a she. In fact, that's one of the interesting things. Over the course of time, the host has sometimes been male, sometimes been female, and the Dax symbiote almost seems gender neutral, very comfortable with either gender. And we'll talk a little bit about gender later on. But I think you've got two distinct separate consciousnesses there. And this idea that it's a single shared consciousness, I just don't think that goes. However, for the host has a tendency, Zachary, to pick up, if you will, the mannerisms and the experiences certainly come to play. I always like those episodes, and they almost use it as a storytelling device. Chief O'Brien is, you know, on Earth with Keiko or whatever, and there is a situation in which, you know, there's this engineering problem that needs to be solved, and you don't have an engineer, so they just kind of turn to Dax and, you know, hey Dax, any chance that any of your previous hosts might know something about this? And she kind of thinks for a second, and she goes, well, let's see, Tobin was an engineer, and I'm sure Tobin knew a lot about this. Hold on, let me fix this. And, you know, and about 3 minutes later, she goes, I think that'll hold. And the problem solved. I think they use it sometimes as a storytelling device, but I think what they're telling us is that even some of the skills and abilities and things of this nature that the previous hosts had can be to some degree passed down to subsequent hosts. In fact, one of the Dax-centric episodes by the same title, Dax, really asks the question, is the Trill responsible for the conduct, for the acts of its antecedent selves? And I think that's really a fascinating question when you're talking about a shared consciousness.
I think my original intuition coming into the show, making these distinctions, was the idea that in some way there has to be some sort of neural fusion between the host brain and the symbiont's brain. We've learned at some point, I'm trying to remember the episode, I can't remember off the top of my head, but I know we've learned at some point that there's some sort of spinal cord connection mm-hmm. between the two. The medium or the mechanism by which this access to the other being's consciousness happens, right? They're fused together in some way. So that started me thinking, well, if they're fused together, I mean, the most radical type of fusion would be that they're so fused that there's only one consciousness. And so isn't that a possibility? And how can we go about dismissing that? And as you were talking, I was thinking of other beings in the Star Trek universe that have access to each other's consciousnesses. And the thing that came to mind while you were talking for me was Betazoids. Mm-hmm. You know, Betazoids have access to each other's thoughts and to some degree each other's experiences insofar as they have access to the other person's thoughts and feelings. But I don't think in the case of Betazoids, you would say that there's a single consciousness. You have two separate consciousnesses that seem to have access to each other. It's almost like radio waves being transmitted, right? You know, it's almost like you're a receiver receiving something coming at you, experiences or awareness or thoughts or communication or something along those lines. And if you interpret what's going on in the trill in that way, I think that gives a lot less credence to the idea that there's a single shared consciousness. You know, if it's just transmission along this, you know, it's almost like telegraph between the symbiont's brain and the host brain. Right? If it's just messages being passed back and forth, you know, as if they're instant messaging over a, you know, a 3-foot wire. A
couple of Dixie cups and a piece of string, Zachary.
Dixie cups and a piece of string, exactly. A couple of Dixie cups. if that's what's going on, that doesn't seem like shared consciousness, even though the two beings could have access to each other's thoughts and feelings and experiences and abilities and whatnot. Another thought that I had is that whichever conclusion we come up with, because I think we kind of, you know, at the end of the day, only one of these two situations can be true. Either there's a single center of experience and a single consciousness, or there's multiple and they're connected or they communicate in some way. Whichever explanation we give has to be compatible with all the things we know for a fact about trills in universe, right? One thing we know is that when the host dies, the symbiont goes on and to live in another host, mm-hmm. and takes those experiences and comes along. Is that more or less compatible with the idea of a single shared consciousness or two and distinct separate consciousnesses? I think obviously if they're separate consciousnesses, then no big deal. You cut the cord and the host dies, the symbiont goes on, it gets implanted in another host, and life goes on for the host. And now the new trill has a bunch of the new host has a bunch of new memories to take into account. I think it's a fuzzier picture if there's a single shared consciousness, because if you have a single consciousness which is the amalgam or the fusion of the two separate consciousnesses before they were joined, when the host dies, what happens to that single shared consciousness? I mean, this is a silly question. I almost don't know how to ask it. Is it split in half? Does the symbiont experience a great sense of loss of identity, of self? You know, what would it mean for a single shared consciousness to lose a major component of that shared consciousness? If it were a genuinely single consciousness and not two separate beings that are just happen to be connected to each other with Dixie cups and a wire.
Well, let's explore this a little bit, because to some degree, we toy with this idea in Deep Space Nine. For Varad, when he stole the symbiote from Jadzia, he becomes a completely separate, unique individual. I mean, when Benjamin Sisko was making the case to Varad's girlfriend that he was going to be different, he likened it to a rebirth.
And that sounds like it gives credence to option number one, that there's actually a single new consciousness that emerges and not two separate beings that happen to communicate with each other.
Yeah, I agree with that to some degree. You know, he goes on to say that he'll be an entirely different person. So yes, I think to some degree that does lend credence to the idea that this is going to be a completely separate person, certainly. We know that once a trill is joined, as Sisko said, he's no longer Varad anymore. He's a blending. And that,
well, I think we need to be a little careful, because I think we're conflating a couple of terms that I think actually mean slightly different things. So a new personality could mean new types of behavior. It could mean that the host takes on certain personality traits of the symbiont, even though there's two separate consciousnesses. So I don't think you can learn a whole lot about whether there's one consciousness or two consciousnesses just from the fact that a new personality emerges. I think the same is true of Betazoids, right? I think Betazoids, when they have their, you know, if they get too involved in someone else's mind, you know, they're someone else's personality can manifest through them. That doesn't mean that there's a single consciousness that's there. So in my mind, I kind of want to bracket the idea of personality in which personality is dominant from these more scientific or more metaphysical issue, maybe the more ontological issue of how many beings there are. Are there two centers of experience and two beings, or one center of experience and one being? Sure. I think the change in personality is compatible with either option.
But the thing with Varad is that when the symbiote was taken back, when he lost the symbiote, he's laying there on the bio bed, and all of a sudden he says that he's forgotten it all. All the experience, all of the knowledge, he's lost it. In fact, Jadzia says something very similar when she wakes up from the initial procedure where Dax is taken and placed in Varad. When she comes to, she says she feels empty. And so, again, I don't know, Zachary. I don't know if that really makes a case for either one of those options or not, because you're right. We're not answering the question: is this a single shared consciousness or two distinct separate consciousness? We don't have anything to really answer that with, except to say that at least in Varad's case, once the symbiote was taken, he reverted to some degree. So we didn't really lose Varad when he was joined with the symbiote. We didn't lose him by putting the Dax symbiote in him. If they're a single shared consciousness, if they become a single unique, you know, if Benjamin Siska's right and this was a rebirth and he becomes a unique individual, I think by taking the symbiote out, I don't know. Maybe I'm chasing a rabbit here, as they say, but wouldn't he once again become you can't just go back to being Varad if there's a single shared consciousness.
I think you're hitting on something really important by focusing on the instances we've seen on screen of a Trill host dying and the symbiote being passed to a new host. And I think in general, we're about to start applying some good old-fashioned scientific methodology to the situation. One of the best ways, I think, of learning about a phenomenon, any phenomenon, is to explore its boundary conditions. You can take any phenomenon you want, right? In what situations is water liquid? In what situations is water a gas? In what situations is water a solid? What are the boundary conditions? What are the change moments that move it from one state to the other? And I think, you know, that's where you really start to learn something about the phenomenon, when you start to explore its boundary conditions. So when you ask when we're asking the question about Trill consciousness, what are the boundary conditions of a Trill consciousness? When does the transition occur? And what have we seen on screen that can illuminate that? So in my mind, I think focusing on these death moments, like when Jadzia dies and we get to see the Dax symbiote passed on to Ezri, we get to see an instance where the Dax symbiote is pulled out of Jadzia. Jadzia hasn't died yet. She's still conscious. She's talking to Worf. She's talking to Sisko on her deathbed. You know, what can we learn about Trill consciousness from that scene? The fact that Ezri has a hard time adapting to being a host when she hasn't had the training, right? What can we learn about that boundary condition, that change moment when Ezri becomes Ezri Dax? And we could find other examples, including the ones you mentioned, but is there anything we can learn from those boundary conditions? Because I think that's where the rubber meets the road. You know, if it's a shared consciousness that's split apart, what happens? Does that give more or less credence to that idea based on what we see on screen? Again, in universe, right? I think, you know, the fun of this is talking about in universe, right? You know, there are no real Trills, and we don't know of any instances of shared consciousness. So this is all a little abstract, and it's all a little hypothetical. So I'm really kind of thinking in universe, what can we learn from this? In those really extreme cases, I think we've seen some of them on screen. I just wonder if they fall into a pattern or if they don't help either case.
Well, again, the episode Dax, we get this kind of wonderful legal drama that unfolds. And really what we're debating inside this episode, Zachary, is really what you and I are more or less trying to answer here. And there's this wonderful scene where kind of both sides have presented their case. And what's happened here? Let me give a little backstory, not necessarily a synopsis, but a little backstory. What's happened here is that the Claystron species, one of their great diplomats, was tragically killed, and his son has come to Deep Space Nine, and he tries to kidnap Jadzia and take him, extradite him back to the Claystrom to stand trial for treason and for the murder of his father. But the crime, allegedly, was committed by Curzon Dax, the previous host of the Dax symbiote. So now Jadzia is having to answer, if you will, for the sins of Curzon Dax, the previous host. And there's this wonderful kind of legal drama that unfolds where they're really debating whether or not, again, she is to be responsible for the acts of the antecedent selves of the Dax symbiote. So the magistrate, Renora, says to her, after both sides have presented their evidence, she says, "Lieutenant Dax, you are either 200 years older than I am, or you're about the same age as my great-granddaughter. At first, I wondered which of those you were. Now I'm bothered by the likelihood that you may be both." And so after she receives evidence, that's her conclusion, Zachary. There is no... We're asking the questions. We're not giving any answers here. Stereotypical Star Trek.
Well, I hope we're doing at least as good of a job as Captain Sisko did in... or Commander Sisko did at that point in Deep Space Nine of making the case for Jadzia Dax being her own being. You know, I don't want to rehash old issues. There are certain issues we've talked about a lot on Metatrex. We did a whole episode on personal identity, and sure. Obviously this is where the rubber meets the road in terms of personal identity, so I don't want to rehash old issues, but I do think there is an important general question about what accounts for a personality being a personality in general. Like, what makes me who I am over time in these different boundary conditions as experiences come and go, over change, over time? And one of the obvious answers philosophically that comes to mind, this is only one answer, of course, but you know, a common answer would be, well, there's a continuity of experience. This is basically the view that David Hume, the philosopher, gave, that there's a continuity of experience, that from moment to moment to moment to moment, you know, even as you go to sleep and come back into being awake, there's a continuity of experience. So from the perspective, I think, of the Dax symbiont, there is a continuity of experience over time, right? As hosts come and go, that experience, that spectrum of experience, or that stream of experience, stays the same, or it increases, but there's a continuity to it from moment to moment, from host to host, right? From the perspective of the host, though, I think the situation is somewhat different. The host might have access to previous memories, but it's not so much a continuity of experience. It's more like a memory or a flashback. It's not sort of living it in real time in streaming mode, right? As I understand it. So I think it kind of depends what you're focusing on. And this is kind of a non-answer. I think, does it make sense to say that the Dax symbiont is the same Dax symbiont over time as hosts come and go? I think very plausibly, I think the answer is yes. There's a continuity to the Dax symbiont experience, especially if they're two distinct and separate consciousnesses. I think it's harder to spell out if you interpret it as being a single joint consciousness. But there's at least a continuity to it, I think, largely because the Dax symbiont is still living. It hasn't died. Mm-hmm. It just goes on, right? From the perspective of the host, I think it's more like a discontinuity of experience, that you might look back at the stream of memories. It's like when Esri gets the Dax symbiont, she gets this flood of, you know, 8 lifetimes worth of experience, mm-hmm. right? And you know, she wasn't there. She didn't experience them. They aren't her memories, but they are memories that she now has access to, and they're hitting her like a flood, and she doesn't know how to process them. It makes an impact on her personality that she's got to process and come to understand. But it doesn't seem right to me to describe it as a continuity of experience in the same way that my day-to-day continuity of experience seems to be. Or even from the Dax symbiont standpoint, the continuity of just experience as hosts come and go, there's a stronger sense of continuity there, I think, than from the perspective of the host. And that sounds so intuitively obvious, but when you put it in those terms, it actually makes the problem harder to figure out. Well, which is it, right? So you have, if there's a shared consciousness here, in any way, shape, or form. Which is it? Is it the continuity of the Dax symbiont's experience that accounts for this the identity over time of this symbiotic being that we call a Trill? Or is there such a discontinuity with the host experience that doesn't make sense anymore? So things like personal identity or responsibility for previous host actions, that those are more problematic and don't seem as plausible. And that's basically the case Sisko was making in that episode of Deep Space Nine. And I think we just don't have enough evidence either way. It's just a question of which is the dominant factor, which is the Dax presence for the host so overwhelming or so dominant that continuative experience is the dominant factor, or is it more like a discontinuous experience from the host's perspective? And it might just be a question of which perspective you're taking.
Well, a couple of things that came to my mind as you were breaking that down. I know for Elon Tandro, who was the Klaestron that was trying to extradite Jadzia Dax back to his homeworld to answer for, and it wasn't necessarily Curzon Dax. It was just Curzon happened to be the host of the symbiote at the time when the alleged crime happened. So certainly for Elon Tandro, his answer to the question is the Dax symbiote is dominant and must be held accountable for the alleged crime. And so I'm not going to say he doesn't care about Jadzia Dax, but certainly Jadzia doesn't really play into this vendetta, if you will, to bring that symbiote back to his homeworld to answer for the death of his father and for the for the crimes that he's been accused of. And then also you mentioned Ezri Dax, and one of the things that I really think is interesting about really the whole first half of the final season of Deep Space Nine, they really seem to be really heavy in exploring her journey as the new host of the Dax symbiote. And one of the things that I really find fascinating, Zachary, is the struggle that she had in trying to make sense of this new reality that she has. And she almost can't remember, okay, do I like that or is this the Dax? And right down to, you know, things I like to eat and things I don't like to eat, and gosh, I don't really like the taste of that. Okay, well, maybe that's Dax. I don't know. She's very confused and she almost can't seem to make sense. So there really is this lack of balance. And I really think at the end of the day, that's what it's about between host and symbiote, is this balance. Because certainly if you look at the relationship that Benjamin Sisko had, and even though we don't get to see the relationship he had with Curzon, he talked about it so much, and it really informs who he is as a character, that it's almost as though Curzon is there a lot. And so we really get to see his relationship with the Dax symbiote through three different hosts.
I guess I keep coming back to the actual words that come out of the Dax, that, you know, the character Dax's mm-hmm. mouth, not the symbiont, but the character Dax. When Jadzia first shows up on Deep Space Nine, she doesn't say, "I remember those great times you had with Curzon." She says, "I'm the same old Dax." And when Ezri is having trouble processing all of these new experiences and memories, she doesn't say, "I remember what it was like to be when Jadzia was married to Worf." She says, "I was married to Worf," right? And this is a much stronger connection than just having access to memories, I think.
Sure, sure. And again, the same problem occurs, and I really wanted to hold on to this until a little bit later, because I know we want to talk a little bit about gender and identity, but this really becomes very complicated later on in the episode Rejoined, in which the Dax symbiote really seems to have a dominating effect over Jadzia's emotions, because another joined Trill shows up on the station. That joined Trill happened to be carrying the Khan symbiote. The Khan symbiote was joined with another host when Tarius who was one of the Dax Symbiote's hosts, who died tragically in a shuttlecraft accident in 2285. He was married as a Joyn Trill to another Joyn Trill, okay? Nilani Khan. And so
this is going to get complicated.
It's complicated because now the Khan symbiote has shown up in another, by the way, female host. And so the Dax symbiote and the Khan symbiote, and certainly we see occasionally in Deep Space Nine where we discover that the symbiotes seem to have some type of nonverbal communication, some type of awareness or something is there, because they immediately recognize one another as being Dax and Khan, not Jadzia and Nilani, but Dax and Khan. And so Dax almost dominates Jadzia to the point that she's ready to run off with this other joined female Trill who's shown up on the station.
You know, I'm so glad we're going this direction, because it's something that it's just so easy to forget what it was like in the 1990s, coming out of the 80s, coming out of the 70s and 60s. You know, this is a really unique time. I think the lexicon that we have in terms of gender identity and gender politics is much richer than the layperson's vocabulary back in the 90s and coming out of the 1980s, right? And I think you know, these obvious distinctions, like the difference between sex and gender, the idea that there's of gender fluidity, that it's not just one or the other, that there's some sort of fluidity between the two, that you can have elements of a male gender and elements of a female gender, and you can identify with more than one. You know, these are just, we kind of take these ideas for granted from a psychological standpoint in the day-to-day layperson's vocabulary these days. And it's, I think it's just easy to forget how groundbreaking this actually was. Here we have what's essentially a transgendered character, right? We've got a Dax who had been male, you know, Curzon Dax, and now Dax has become female, Jadzia Dax. And that was a groundbreaking concept on television at the time. I mean, almost to the point of being scandalous. I think of other TV shows not too many years before, like there's an episode of, remember that old TV show Night Court? Remember that show?
Yeah, I love that show.
There was an episode where I think Dan, the prosecutor's, like one of his buddies from back in the day, ends up having a sex change and comes back onto the show as a woman. and this was scandalous at the time, right? This TV never had any of this, right? And so here we have essentially a character that has changed genders as a fundamental aspect of the character written into the show. And that's really groundbreaking. It's a very Star Trek thing to do, right? Push the boundaries and take those concepts and push them in new directions. But I still sort of feel like they played it safe, frankly. I think it would have been more interesting to, you know, I think in terms of our day-to-day perceptions, I think it would have been more interesting to see the genders reversed. Like, it would have been interesting to see a female Dax having, you know, going into a male host and having that female influence on a male. That would have been much more scandalous, I think, in the 90s than having a female character basically getting to act, you know, having this male influence on her personality. And Jadzia, as a scientist, kind of has this rational aspect to her personality that's traditionally associated with male attributes. And I think they just kind of played that safe. It makes sense. I think coming out of the 70s and 80s and the second wave feminist movement, I think there's a lot of factors that go into why Jadzia, the character, was conceived the way she was, and the influences and how the actress portrayed the character. But I think all of that kind of plays it safe. I would like to have seen an even more radical take on that. And the episode you mentioned is probably the most radical, pushing of the boundaries.
Certainly.
from a gender politics, gender identity, gender fluidity standpoint. And again, I think this is one of these things where if you didn't grow up in that earlier era, you may not appreciate how radical this actually was, to have what's essentially a gender switching character as one of your main characters on a major TV show. That was totally groundbreaking for television. It was even groundbreaking for Star Trek. And it's underappreciated these days. And I think from my point of view, it's just really interesting to see how our vocabulary has changed. You know, now we take these concepts totally for granted. And back in the 90s, this was groundbreaking.
Yeah. We don't have any idea in terms of the gender or if there, I mean, it, there could be gender neutrality among the symbiotes. So we have no idea what's going on as far as gender, at least that we know of within the Star Trek universe.
But we never learn that, do we?
Yeah. I'm sorry?
We never learn that, do we?
No. No, that's right. What I'm saying. We never really learned that. And so, you know, what's happened here in this episode Rejoined, I mean, this is not Tarius, who was a male host, and Nilani. This is Jadzia and Lenara, two female hosts. And really, it's not so much the hosts, I think, that are attracted to one another. It's the symbiotes. It's the symbiotes who still have that romantic, deep connection. It's Dax and Khan.
But from a very androgynous standpoint, it sounds like if they're not obviously gendered and we never learn it, is this evidence for the fact that the Trill symbionts are gendered, or is this evidence for their androgyny?
I think the latter, personally, and I don't really have a lot of evidence, you know, on that, except the fact that we never really explore gender among the Trill, and they seem to be very, very comfortable, at least accepting the identity of their host as far as their gender is concerned. I mean, Jadzia Dax never had a problem saying, well, you know, I've been married X number of times, and, you know, so many times as a husband and so many times as a wife, or I've been a parent, you know, I've done this before a couple times as a dad, a few times as a mom. And so there's no, and again, in the 1990s, I mean, we're talking about, you know, the mid 1990s, at least for 1995 for Rejoined. October 1995. So we're really pushing boundaries here in the mid 90s.
Yeah, I mean, think about what would happen in the space of, say, 5 years. I don't know the exact year, but I'm thinking of the episode of Star Trek The Next Generation where the Trill are introduced and we get to see what's essentially a gender switch on screen, right? The Trill, Ambassador Odan goes from a male host into a female host, and Odan is still in love with Dr. Beverly, right? And, you know, just 5 years before, we have a character on what's essentially a hit Star Trek TV show, very popular network TV show. It's syndicated, but a popular mainstream TV show that basically says, I'm sorry, I just can't handle that. That's too out there even for me here in the 24th century. Right? And, you know, 5 years later, here we are. Here we go. The culture had changed so much to the point where it's still boundary pushing, but I think the boundaries had been pushed a bit more by the mid 90s than say circa 1990 with that episode of The Next Generation.
Yeah, Zachary. So you're referencing the episode The Host, and that premiered in May of 1991. And yes, at the end of that episode, what happens is Commander Riker could no longer tolerate the Trill symbiote. It was there was an incompatibility issue there, and I think that got a little weird for Beverly first of all, because, you know, she certainly had an attraction to Odan. And it was fascinating to me that we apparently have a long history with the Trill, but Beverly had no idea that, as Jadzia says in Far Beyond the Stars, that he's got a worm in his belly.
I don't think you see a whole lot of Riker Beverly fan fiction, but there's got to be some out there.
There's got to be, because there was, I mean, she was willing to set her discomfort aside and accept him, as certainly with Counselor Troy's advice there. But at the end of the episode, you're absolutely right. What happens is now the symbiote is passed to a female who comes in, obviously, with the same emotions. And we don't really know whether they're Odans or whether they belong to the symbiote. But certainly there's something there, and there's a connection to Dr. Beverly. But yeah, she kind of passes, puts up her hands.
She's weirded out. Let's
that's
just say
a little
she's
too weird
out, right?
For me. And yes. But interesting that we, from May 1991 to October 1995, we bridged that gap.
Yeah, and I just don't know, because I was still fairly young then. I was in my, let's see, mid-90s. I was, you know, creeping up on being, you know, 17-ish. And, you know, I just don't know how much we're reading into that difference. You know, is this a genuine culture shift that happened in that brief time period? Or were they just plain trying to, you know, be more edgy, where, you know, was it culturally reinforced, or was this dominated by the writers, you know, trying to push something a certain direction without much regard for the surrounding culture? I think one was probably more scandalous, and one was easier, you know, in that short space of 5 years. I mean, the evolution in our cultural thinking and cultural awareness about these concepts, I think, happened at a very rapid rate. I mean, rapid in the sense of a few years or a couple of decades. You know, it didn't take a century. It didn't take 200 years. That's right. A very rapid change, I think, culturally.
Well, I do recall. I was married by the mid 1990s.
Yeah, you're older than I am.
So, yeah, yeah, a few years older than you. And you know, it's fascinating to me, and not to move away from Star Trek, but you know, I remember when, for instance, Ellen DeGeneres had a hit sitcom, and she came out as being a lesbian, and it destroyed the show. The show was gone almost immediately after that. So what literally happened over the course of a few years is, yes, TV writing got a little edgier, and shows like Star Trek were pushing the boundaries. And I know that a lot of times fans are critical of Star Trek for not pushing the boundaries further. But you have to go back to the mid-1990s. Believe me, the host was edgy. There was nothing safe about the idea of two women on, or at least one woman being attracted to another woman. That was very edgy in 1991. But yes, by 1995, we still weren't there, but we were in a position where, okay, the Star Trek writers are going to push the boundaries a little bit more. And now we're going to have two, at least what we perceive as two women with a romantic connection to one another. So that was written in. And yes, they're pushing boundaries. No, we're not there yet, but we're going to push the envelope that much further.
Well, I think this is totally in line with what I was saying earlier about boundary conditions. I think if you want to learn something, in this case, Star Trek is an exploration of the human condition. If you want to learn something about the human condition, you push the boundaries, explore the boundary conditions. And at the time, this was a boundary, right? Now it's a little, you know, it doesn't phase us. It's not scandalous. It's comfortable. But back then it was scandals. It was a boundary condition on the general human experience, or at least the popular perception of the human experience, right? And Star Trek's ability to kind of get in there into that boundary condition and play and tweak and explore and, you know, come up with character variations and character traits and interesting dilemmas. You know, this is Star Trek's way of pushing the human condition forward and learning something essential about who we are as people based on those boundary conditions. I think it's the same kind of productive, it's productive drama. It's educational. It's philosophical in the same way that we were trying to explore the boundary conditions of a Trill in terms of, you know, when it's the host dies and when the symbiont is transplanted into a new host. Those boundary conditions teach us something about the Trill. And this pushing the boundaries of the human condition in terms of exploring these gender politics issues is a way of teaching us something essential about who we are as people, as this shared human experience.
In the episode Invasive Procedures, Zachary, Benjamin Sisko is really pleading to some degree with Varad to, let's go back down to sick bay and let's put that symbiote back where it belongs. Let's fix this situation. And really, Sisko isn't trying to appeal to Varad because, hey, Varad's already... You know, Varad's already come on the station, has already, you know, taken Jadzia down there and forced her to give up the symbiote. You got two Klingon thugs and, you know, a woman that used to work at a comfort facility. She never quite says what she was, but it you know, it kind of sounds like she was probably a prostitute or, you know, something of that nature.
She stirred the mud.
She stirred the mud. Yes, she stirred the mud, gave him comfort. And so, you know, he's fallen in love with her. She's fallen in love with him. She definitely fallen in love with him. I think he's using her. But now we've got Varad Dax. this whole other being. So Sisko isn't trying to appeal to Varad. Sisko's talking to Dax. Hey, you remember when? Hey, you remember my wedding? I remember the bachelor party. You know, and so that conversation's going on, and he's trying to do a couple of things. First of all, he's trying to convince Varad's girlfriend that this isn't the same guy he was before he went down to sickbay. Number two, he's trying to appeal to the Dax symbiote. Hey, listen, you and I, we're friends. He's not friends with Varad. Varad's his enemy, but he and Dax are friends. Dax, let's go down there. And this is a nuance in the acting, a nuance in the writing, I'm not sure, but John Glover does this so well. He almost, his whole manner morphs, and he becomes very thoughtful. And you suddenly realize that, okay, this isn't Varad talking now. This is Dax. So, Zachary, I think we see here a shift in which Varad no longer has the dominance, but Dax has the dominance. And Dax invokes self-preservation. Can't do that, Benjamin. I'm too weak from the procedure. If I go back down there and I do it, I might die. And yeah, it's a shame about that girl, but I got to take care of me. And I'm paraphrasing that. But we're still friends, right? Sisko says, heck no, we're not friends any longer. Our friendship is dead.
See, this question of dominance is actually kind of interesting because it seems so asymmetrical. Like, imagine if the Dax symbiont is dominant, then no big deal, right? You know, the host gets to walk around, at least experience whatever the Dax symbiont is experiencing. And, you know, there's no kind of imprisonment. But imagine being the Dax symbiont when the host is dominant. How imprisoning that must be. You don't even get to walk around and according to your own volition. You just get to sort of be this passive, non-dominant being stuck inside the other being. If there's two different consciousnesses. So it seems so asymmetrical. And that's the thing that I think is so interesting and weird about this symbiotic relationship. It's not like a case of like conjoined twins or something, right? Where, you know, they're both out functioning with the same sensory awareness or sort of equal sensory awareness. You know, each being having its own eyes and its own ears, you know, conjoined together in some way. It's that one is really the eyes and the ears for the other, and the other one gets to walk around and have volitions and do whatnot, and the other gets to be stuck inside the other one. It's really an asymmetrical symbiotic relationship. It seems to me that a genuinely symbiotic relationship would at least be more more symmetrical and maybe not as parasitic as this.
Yeah, I think we need to go back to the etymology of the word symbiont again. Again, breaking it down, together life, a being sharing life together. So when we're talking about the fact that, you know, Sisko's having this conversation, that almost seems like there is a... I'm not going to call it a tug of war, but a give and take, I think, is probably the best way of putting it. And we see this several times in which host and symbiote almost invoke one another to become dominant. Jadzia is able to pull upon past experiences. But I have to say that we're not just talking about the previous hosts, because these creatures actually can live independently of their host.
In the mud.
In fact, Dax was 150 years old before he was ever joined. So 150 years in the mud, there are certain experiences there. But perhaps for the benefit, as you said, Zachary, and I like the way that you put that, eyes and ears. You know, being eyes and ears, putting feet, getting, I got to get out of the mud and live life a little bit. I got to get out of this mud.
After 150 years of sitting around in the mud, that's got to be one relaxed symbiont.
Yeah. But there again, it shows that at least for the symbiote on Trill, you know, that there's life beyond the mud and they know that.
Life beyond the mud, I love it. But I get the thing that's so weird. I mean, I think you're right. So there's this kind of I want to say fluidity because we use that term in another context, but there's kind of a movement, a shifting back and forth between the host being more dominant and the symbiont being more dominant. It's not as schizophrenic as what you see in, say, Masks, the episode of The Next Generation, where Data is manifesting different personalities, right? That's really schizophrenic. There's genuinely sort of different multiple personalities. There's kind of a sharp break from one. Another one starts manifesting. That one ends. Mm-hmm. Now it's a different personality. That's not what's going on with the Trill. It's a blending. It's a blending. It's a fluidity. It's like mixing oil paints or something. Right? It's like Bob Ross mixing oil paints. You know, he doesn't mix it so thoroughly that the colors aren't there. He makes it marbly. Right.
But Zachary, we figure out in Facets, at least, and maybe this was unique because of Odo being a changeling, when Curzon is removed and placed into Odo, there's a conscious decision by both Curzon's consciousness and Odo that, okay, we're going to live separately. And we figure out in the course of this episode that, yeah, I mean, that can be done. It'll take some time for her to really adjust to the new balance. But yeah, you know, and so this is more than just memories. This is a living on of consciousness within the Dax symbiote.
You know, there's kind of an interesting philosophical experiment about consciousness involved here, because we mentioned that the host is you know, to use an expression, the eyes and ears of the symbiont, kind of literally in this sense.
Yeah.
But in a way, it's like a remote sensory apparatus. So you can kind of ask the question, okay, where, if that's true, if the Dax symbiont is getting its sensory awareness from the host, you know, literally eyes and ears, does it have its own? I don't know if we know the answer. Does it have its own sensory apparatus? Does it hear? Does it see? Does it smell? Does it feel impulses on its skin? You know, if that's all true, then it seems like, okay, if it can experience all of those things on its own without the host, you know, 150 years, you know, feeling sensual pleasure in the mud, you know, then it seems like, okay, that's got its own consciousness. It's got its own self-awareness. But if that's not the case and it's getting all of its sensory awareness from the host, you know, that's not implausible. I don't know if we know enough to know one way or the other in universe. If it's getting all of its sensory inputs from the host, then it raises this interesting question. It's kind of like consciousness at a distance. You know, if I were hooked up to some machine that gave me all my sensory apparatus from remote, where would I experience my consciousness? Would I experience it here where my brain is, or would I experience it out there somewhere where my sensory apparatus is picking up the information? Where would I kind of perceive myself as being? And I think you can ask a very interesting question about the symbiont in that case. Is the symbiont perceiving itself being there, sort of physically located, you know, spatially inside the abdomen of the host, or is it experiencing things from the perspective of the hosts, because that's where all of its sensory apparatus, where its vision, where its sense, and where its taste is coming from?
I'm going to answer that by saying I think the answer is in the neural link that exists between the symbiote and the host. I mean, this isn't as you refer to it, spooky dualism or anything like that. I mean, we're not talking about a Katra.
Yes, yeah, so this is a biological phenomenon. Right?
Yes, we're talking about a biological link between these two creatures.
Exactly.
So to answer your question, I do think that it's more than just, I think it does sense and feel and experience. And I do think that when Ezri drank that Ractogeno, I think the Dax symbiote wanted the Ractogeno. I want to taste a Ractogeno. I need a Ractogeno. I need a caffeine.
Can you imagine? I imagine this frustrated Dax symbiont, like, you know, I desperately want this Ractogeno, and damn it, Ezri doesn't want one.
She hates it.
Darn it! All I want is a Ractogeno on a Tuesday morning.
Gotta wait freaking 60 years for another Ractogeno.
It's the longest waiting period ever. You think waiting for a turbo lift is tedious? Try waiting 60 years for a Ractogeno.
I'm sure the Dax symbiont probably thought, I'll just keep hitting her with the impulse. Eventually she'll get used to it. And it's an acquired taste. Let's hope. That or this is going to be a long relationship. Just put me back in the mud.
At least in the mud pit, someone will bring you a Ractogeno, right? picture a little waiter, you know, coming in with a little tray full of
Rakuten. Just pour it in the mud. Just pour it in the mud. But again, I don't think we're really answering the question, you know, is this a single shared consciousness, two distinct separate consciousness? Is one dominant? Is the other dominant? I think at the end of the day, it's just as the Dax character becomes a blending of all of its previous hosts, I think all four of these options can be true at any given time.
Well, like as often so many times here in Metatrex, I don't feel like I have the answer to any of these philosophical questions, frankly. I feel like what's interesting about them is the fact that they're kind of paradoxical. Your intuitions can be pulled different directions. Seems like those intuitions don't match. We have some evidence for one interpretation, some evidence for the other interpretation. So which is it at the end of the day? I think it is important, I think, philosophically and rationally to say, well, look, it can't be both of these, right? It's got to be one or the other. There's either one center of experience or there's more than one center of experience. It literally just can't be both because that's a contradiction. And we may not be able to settle the issue, but I think it's important to think about it structurally. And like when in all of these cases of paradoxical intuitions, you know, you can't kind of have your cake and eat it too. Or the reality is a certain way, one or the other. We may not ever have enough evidence to be able to settle these issues. You know, some of these philosophical issues we discuss on Metatrex might be open issues from now until the end of humanity, right? For all we know, because, you know, we just don't have enough evidence to settle the issue, or the intuitions are seem genuinely paradoxical or seem to conflict with each other. But I think the danger, the thing that's always a little disappointing to me is when the episodes themselves get a little wishy-washy, like when they start to conflate terms and be a little inconsistent. And sometimes that's done dramatically mm-hmm. to tell a story. And sometimes it's just lazy writing. Sometimes it's lazy terminology. So I think a lot of the value of having these kinds of discussions, I think, is just to kind of structure your terminology and make those important distinctions. So when you're taking a situation like this that seems paradoxical, you have the lexicon and the vocabulary to be able to break that concept down into its essential components. Like here, I don't think we can settle the issue, but we at least know what the discussion should be, right? How many consciousnesses are there? That's an important fundamental question. And if you don't ask that question, you're just going to end up with wishy-washy philosophical discussion. So I'm not sure we've had a profound philosophical discussion today. Quite the opposite, probably. But I think we've asked all the right questions. Sure. And I just don't think we get enough evidence in universe to be able to genuinely answer the question.
I think one of the things that makes this really difficult, Zachary, is the fact that we compound the situation with these multiple lifespans, these multiple antecedent selves of the Dax symbiote. I mean, let's meander a second through the life and times of Dax, okay? Dax is born on Trill in 2018, but as I said previously, not joined with a host until, you know, 2168. So, you know, 150 years of life in the mud. And so then Leela, who was 48 when she applied to be joined, according to the episode Equilibrium, and she had to wait 8 years before she was accepted for joining. So Leela becomes the first host of the Dax symbiote in 2168. Okay, Leela was a legislator. Next was Tobin. Tobin was an engineer, followed by Emini. Now, Emini, as you may recall, was an Olympic gymnast who met a rather young Leonard McCoy when he was a student at Old Miss, at least according to Trials and Tribulations. She always knew he'd be a doctor because he had the hands of a surgeon. After Emini came Audred. Now, Audred was at one time the head of the Trill Symbiosis Commission. Audred was female, and then briefly there was a pilot after Audred, Tarius. Again, Tarius was the one who died tragically as a result of a shuttlecraft accident in 2285. He had only been joined for about a full year, not even a full year. He was married to another joined Trill, as we talked about previously, Nilani Khan. We found that out in the episode Rejoined. And so now here's where things get a little contentious, at least for the Trill Symbiosis Commission. Dax, the symbiote, was given to Joran, this renowned musician turned serial killer. And I guess, Zachary, on Trill, the punishment for a capital crime. Now, here's the interesting thing.
Back in the mud?
Back in the mud. No, here's the interesting thing. you know, who's responsible for these murders? Because it wasn't one murder. I was talking to a fan a while back who thought it was one murder. No, it was at least three murders. I mean, Duran was, in the Star Trek universe, really a serial killer. And so on Trill, the punishment was to take the Trill symbiote from him. It was a death sentence. Everyone knows about 96 hours, you take that symbiote out, the host most likely is going to die. According to Sisko, going to bleed to death. There's evidently something with that connection that doesn't allow for clotting. They're going to bleed to death. So it's really more than a neural connection, I think. And so the punishment for these capital crimes was having to give up the symbiote. So I think that really plays back into, you know, who's responsible. Evidently, the Trill Symbiosis Commission either thought that Dax was too precious or not responsible. So they punished Duran by taking the symbiote. Duran dies. And so then the symbiote was given to Curzon, mentor of Benjamin Sisko, Curzon to Jadzia, Jadzia to Varad, and then back to Jadzia again, and then to Ezri. And so there you have it. Unless you go to the alternative future timeline and you want to throw in Yedrin, who was Jadzia's great-grandson. That is the life and times of Dax.
Well, Mike, you know, this is obviously one of the defining characteristics of a Trill, this concept of multiple lifespans. And again, it depends which perspective you're taking, right? If it's the perspective of the symbiont, then it's one very long lifespan. If it's the perspective of the memories of any particular host, looking back at the memories of previous hosts, then it seems like multiple lifespans, multiple shorter lifespans. Which is it? It doesn't really matter, I think. You know, we can hash that issue till Kingdom Come. We probably won't come up with an answer. But I think for me, you know, as I get a little older, I find myself more and more intrigued by these characters in Star Trek that live a long time. And we have a few of them, Vulcans and Romulans. We've got, Trill that live, you know, the symbionts live however long they live, some hundreds of years. You know, we live, what, 70 or 80 or 90 or 100 years? And, you know, I'm 38. You're a little older than I am. You're creeping up on halfway through that journey, if you're not more than halfway already. and that's kind of a depressing thought. It just speaks to the limitations of the human condition. And I love that Star Trek, you know, makes an effort to put characters in that have transcended at least the human limitation of a certain number of years in some way. And has asked the question, what would that mean? What would it mean to have not just 70 years that I'm halfway through? What would it mean to have 100 years or 150 years or 200 or 300 or 500 years? Right? What would the meaning of life be if you had that longer time frame? I recently saw a headline. I'm sure I'm going to butcher the memory of seeing this headline, but there was they're pretty sure they discovered like a species of shark that has been alive for 300 or 400 years, and it's one of the longest living non-tree life form. You know, trees are well known to live a long time, you know, hundreds of years, but this is a very long living animal species. And that's fascinating. I mean, think about what our world was like 300 or 400 years ago, right? I mean, this predates the founding of the United States. I mean, look how much change the world has undergone. Mm-hmm. Imagine what it would be like to see that much change in the world. You know, how would that change your perspective? What would that change about what you want to accomplish in life? What would that do for your motivation to do things? For me, I think that finite lifespan is kind of a motivating factor. I want to do as much as I can in this lifetime so I can not feel like I wasted it at the end of the day. If I had 500 years, I might not get out of bed every day, right? So what exactly is the motivating factor? And I think the fact that there's multiple hosts, that helps because you get the sort of psychological input from the host in the situation. The host's unique abilities and talents and goals and whatnot inform this symbiotic relationship. Jadzia lives a very different life than Ezri, who lives a very different life than Curzon, right? And even though there's a symbiotic relationship. But from the perspective of the Dax symbiont, if it's genuinely a separate consciousness, there's got to be this... It seems like it's one of two ways. Is there a continual drive for novelty, to keep doing new experiences, to keep accomplishing things, because you've got a longer time period, which means you have a longer chance to make an impact on the universe around you? Or is there this kind of existential tedium? I think after 500 years, it's like, God, not another day where I have to get up, put me back in the mud and, you know, put me out of my misery, right? which is it for the the Trill symbionts. You know, I could see it going either way, and it probably depends on personality, but I think it would certainly change my perspective on the meaning of life if I knew I had 300 or 400 years and not just the 80 years I'm allotted, give or take, if I'm lucky.
I think you make a really fascinating point, and it caused me to think back again to the episode Dax. At the end of the episode, the widow of the fallen Claystrom hero, played masterfully by Fiona Flanagan. Everybody knows that I love, love, love Fiona Flanagan. There's this wonderful scene where she's walking with Jadzia and they're talking about the trial, and they're reflecting on, you know, what had happened to her husband. We discover that that actually he died as a result of his own betrayal of his people. If there was any kind of betrayal, it was a betrayal of his own, and the rebels killed him as a result of his helping them. And so they're talking, and they stop in the corridor there on the promenade, and Mrs. Tondreau reaches up, puts her hand on Jadzia's cheek, and she says to Jadzia, "Live, Jadzia Dax, live a long, fresh, and wonderful life." And I there's something really beautiful about that, because you make the point that for the symbiote, you know, there are these multiple lifetimes, hundreds of years. We don't really have any reason, at least I don't think, and certainly if one of our listeners can think of a case where we have some information on this, certainly let us know. But we don't have any reason. There's nothing really to inform us as to whether or not the Trill live any longer, Zachary, than you or I, at least the hosts. And so, you know, and the unfortunate thing is Jadzia doesn't live much longer, if just a few years after this incident. But there's something really beautiful there, because it was an elder woman speaking to a young woman, 28, I believe, at the time, Jadzia, telling her to live a long, fresh, wonderful life. She wasn't talking to Dax. She was talking to this beautiful young woman who was ready to give up her life to keep this woman's secret. And she was saying to her, live that wonderful, long, fresh, wonderful life. And Zachary, at the end of the day, I think a character like Dax reminds me that there really are no limits. You think about all of the things that the Dax symbiotes experienced over these multiple lifetimes, but really that's possible for us. I think about just a crazy past couple of years. And I mean, my goodness, a couple of years ago, we didn't even know each other. You or I had never podcast before. And, you know, now we're hosting a podcast and talking Star Trek. And you and I were talking in the Turbo Lift a couple of weeks ago. You know, you're doing some tech inventing and all of these fun, incredible things and learning new things. I remember a few years ago, I'd always wanted to play guitar. So, you know, I took some guitar lessons and, you know, I'm learning to play guitar. And you say, well, you know, 45 years old, you know, if I live to be 90, I've expended half my life. But the reality is, you know, I still have breath in me and I have this opportunity to live a long, fresh, and wonderful life, to experience things, to go out into the world and achieve and do. And I think if there's a takeaway from Dax, it's that, you know what, we can go out there and we can experience different things. We can try new things. And yeah, sometimes that Ractogino is not going to taste so good and we're going to spit it out and we're going to try something else. But, you know, doggone it, at least we can say we tried it.
You know, I think there's nothing more inspiring than when there's a person who's getting on in years but refuses to get old. And I was just thinking about this, like, what are my real experiences of this? My grandmother, She taught me almost everything that I know in life that's important and interesting, frankly. I was probably 16 years old and we went on a trip to Tuolumne Meadows in Yosemite together, which is a place my family had been going to for decades at that point. And she hadn't been in a few years. And so she took me camping in Yosemite. She's in her probably early, creeping up on mid 80s at mm-hmm. this point. And I was going to go hiking up a mountain in Yosemite called Mount Unicorn, Unicorn Peak. And it was just a day trip. I was going to hike to a lake. Then I was going to go up the mountain and come down. And my grandmother said, why don't I hike to the lake with you? And then you can go up the mountain and come down and we'll hike back together. And I'm thinking, this is a terrible idea. She literally just had a knee replacement. and she was going to hike 3 miles to a lake while I was going to go up the mountain and then, you know, let me go up the mountain and down. And I'm just thinking, this is not a good idea. You just had a knee replacement, grandmother. I'm thinking to myself. And so we start the hike and maybe a mile into it, she says, you know, I'm getting a little tired. Why don't you go on ahead? And, you know, and I'm thinking to myself, you're going to fall down. You're going to get hurt. You know, a bear's going to eat you, something. And she says, no, I'll be fine. Just you go finish the hike, go up the mountain, come down. I'll meet you at the lake. And so I did, you know, I took her word for it. I was 15 or 16 years old. And I just did what my grandmother said. Okay, fine. If you think you'll be okay, I went. It seems terrible in retrospect. I left my grandmother to be eaten by a bear. But so I go up the mountain and I come down and, you know, lo and behold, there's my grandmother with her feet in the lake, looking happy as a clam, pleased, you know, grinning ear to ear because she was able to hike to 3 miles to a lake in her 80s, right? After a knee replacement. And it was one of the most inspiring things I've ever seen, because she just refused to get old, you know, as her body was, you know, kind of falling apart there towards the end. You know, she just ignored it and kept doing new things and interesting things and pushing herself and challenging herself. And I mean, any of us who are getting older at one point has said to ourselves, wouldn't it be great if I could be young again, if I could take all of this wisdom that I have now and, you know, put myself back in a more youthful body? You know, look at what I would have done, you know, if I could be that age again with all my experiences and all my wisdom. And, you know, you get to actually see that in the trill, you know, in the trill species. You know, the hosts get old and their bodies fall apart. They experience all the same aging we do, but the symbiont gets to get taken out of that and plunked into a new body, a more youthful body, and take all that wisdom and all that experience and live a more youthful life. And I just kind of picture this increasing, increasingly wise, increasingly experienced, but all the good perspective that would come along with that, not just sort of, you know, being an old person in a young person's body, but I think being able to combine the best of being young, all the abilities that you have when you're young, the way your body supports what you want to do when you're young, with all the wisdom of your mind and your experiences, you know, as you age, if you combine those together, what a powerful being a trill must be. The symbiotic species is a trill. They combine the best of youth and the biology with the best of age and the experiences of the mind and the symbiont. Put them together, and you get a pretty powerful being. I think which of us wouldn't be envious of to be able to, you know, experience sure. that kind of. It's not a fountain of youth, but it's being able to sort of, you know, turn back the biological clock and take the mental component along with you into the next lifespan.
That's the beauty of the episode Playing God, which is a great trill episode, by the way. The great thing about this is Jadzia, who is joined obviously with Dax, has an opportunity to work with Arjun, who is preparing to be joined. And Arjun is inexperienced and he's taking this so seriously, and he's just putting his heart and soul in this. There's no time to yuck it up. You know, I'm going to take this seriously. And he's just appalled at Jadzia, who stays up all night and parties, and she just doesn't seem to take things seriously. And she more or less says this to him, you know, listen, enjoy life, relax. And it's this wonderful passing of hundreds of years of wisdom and experience to this young guy who hasn't even been joined yet. And you know what? You've got to learn to live a little bit. And I really think if there's a message that we can get from the trill, at the end of the day, are we going to answer any deep philosophical questions on this? No. But there's this wonderful takeaway, and that's live life, relax, and live life. That's my takeaway.
I mean, yeah, Jadzia gets to plausibly say, hey, look, I'm 28 again. I get to drink like a fish and play Dabo without being passed out on the corner. I'm going to take my chance, you know?
Tonga, man. Let's sit. I'm going to take that crazy Ferengi's Latinum. Well, before we, and Zachary, those were my final thoughts, but I do want to, I promised a essential DAX list. I've mentioned a lot of these during the podcast, but just in case our listeners want to, you know, just binge watch some good DAX episodes and look at the evolution of the DAX character in some degree here within Deep Space Nine. The Emissary, obviously, we are introduced to Jadzia DAX. I think that's really essential. The episode DAX, I've mentioned several times, the actual episode DAX. Invasive Procedures, Equilibrium, Facets, the episode I just mentioned, Playing God, Rejoined. And then for an exploration of Ezri DAX, Image in the Sand, and really the first three or four episodes of that final season of Deep Space Nine are really a great exploration, but Image in the Sand definitely is on my essentials list. Field of Fire, and I definitely want to throw in TNG's fourth season, Introduction to the Trill, we mentioned previously, entitled The Host. So that's my essential Trill, essential DAX list.
That's a great essentials list. It's actually an interesting way to do a rewatch of, like, an abbreviated rewatch of Deep Space Nine, is to do the Trill rewatch or the DAX rewatch.
Yeah, indeed. Any other final thoughts?
No, I don't think so. Nothing I haven't already said. I think that the thing that's so interesting about the DAX character is its almost paradoxical nature. You know, again, we can only have this discussion in the abstract because I don't have any experience of a joint consciousness, and neither do you. And as far as we know, no one does. So it's we can't help but just kind of hypothesize. And I do think it's important to bring our sort of philosophical razor to the discussion and make some distinctions and say, look, it's got to be one way or the other. And we can look at the evidence for and against each view. And we may not be able to settle at the end of the day, but I think it's important to look at the evidence for and against each way of interpreting the DAX character. And I think philosophically it's important. At the end of the day, it's like any other philosophical problem. We will probably be debating it until the end of humanity. So I don't think we're going to settle the issue, but I do think the activity itself is valuable. And I think we can learn a lot about Trill in the Trills as a species, or DAX in particular, from going through the exercise. You know, for me, again, I it's interesting because if I were asking these questions 10 years ago, I think my perspective would just be different. I didn't find the DAX character as interesting, frankly, 10 years ago or 20 years ago, as I do now, halfway through life's journey. The idea of a being that lives hundreds of years and multiple lifetimes and gets to be young again, that's mm-hmm. more and more appealing the older I get, as practically speaking, my days are more and more numbered with every year and decade that goes by. So it does, for me, continually sort of force these questions of meaning that I ask now that I didn't ask 10 years ago or didn't ask 20 years ago. Definitely not when I was studying philosophy. And as recently as a few years ago, I would not have been as interested in that angle. And I think that's where we have a better chance of actually reaching some conclusions, because we do have the experience of death and a finite lifespan and mm-hmm. all of the practical consequences thereof. You know, I don't know if we can learn anything with practical consequence from analyzing, you know, the nature of Trill consciousness, you know, one consciousness or multiple consciousnesses. It's so abstract, I don't see any real practical consequence. We'll learn more from doing neurobiology here on Earth than we will from that discussion, right? So, but I think we can learn a lot about what we want out of life and what we would do if we had a longer lifespan, and, you know, what we see in terms of, you know, wisdom combined with age, combined with, you know, your body's limitations or abilities and whatnot. I think that's a human life, and you can learn a lot about, you know, the human condition from pushing it to its boundary conditions in the various ways we've talked about with the DAX character. So yeah. I think that's the more productive part of the discussion from a reaching actual conclusions standpoint. So I think those are my final thoughts.
Yeah. We didn't answer any deep philosophical questions, but, you know, I will say I really enjoyed hanging out in the mud with you, Zachary. But I got to be honest, my fingers are getting really wrinkly. So it's been fun talking about Jadzia DAX and the Trill, but this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, The Ready Room. You know, Pushing Daisies and Hannibal are two very different shows, but they both have a very strong visual look and a very strong storytelling style and a point of view. And one is quirky and one is darkly quirky and one is whimsically quirky.
Standard Orbit.
Just across the board, it gives you space adventure because they go to the galactic barrier. It gives you the personal dilemma, which is what Star Trek's all about, exploring the human condition. And it gives you just a fun action adventure as well. So just great entertainment.
The 602 Club.
With the idea of putting your faith in a lie, what do you put your faith in? And is it strong enough to hold it? What they're asking Gotham to put their faith in is a lie. And the moment, again, it comes out, it's not going to be good. And that always struck me as something that's going to be really interesting.
Saturday Morning Trek.
And all these things just brought in more and more people who thought they were alone, and they found each other, and they made their clubs, and then they made conventions. And that's what the 70s were about, was getting Star Trek back and finding each other.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, no problem. We've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course, you can always stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way you can help us keep all our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels along with all the great perks that we have for you. These perks include things like early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and many, many more. We really appreciate any support that you can give us, and we hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. And don't forget to check out Enterprise in Space, a project of the nonprofit National Space Society that will design and launch an 8-foot orbiter and return the craft to Earth. The NSS Enterprise Orbiter will carry more than 100 student-designed science experiments into space, and you can help make it happen. Visit enterpriseinspace.org to find out more and to get your seat on the mission. If you'd like to contact us with feedback or suggestions for the show, or to send us your thoughts on anything we discussed in this episode of Metatrex, you can contact us in several different ways. You can contact us via a form. Just go to trek.fm/contact.
If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, you can look in the sidebar on our show page on the Trek FM website, or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm.
Follow us on Twitter. Our Twitter handle is @TrekFM.
On Facebook, you can find us at facebook.com/TrekFM, and find us in the Babel Conference, Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group. Just type the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it'll come right up. Or you can go to our website at trek.fm and click discussion on the menu bar.
We'd also like to invite you to leave a rating and review of Metatrex on iTunes. We'd love to hear your feedback and suggestions for the show. Well, Zachary, when you're not hanging out in this mud bath with all these symbiotes, where can our listeners find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
On Facebook, you can find me in the Babel Conference, Trek FM's listeners-only discussion group, if you want to talk Star Trek and philosophy with me there. And you can find me on Twitter. My handle is just my name, @ZacharyFruehling. That's Zachary, Z-A-C-H-A-R-Y, and Fruehling, F-R-U-H-L-I-N-G. And Mike, when you're not sharing experiences with your symbiont, where can people find you on the interwebs and around the Trek FM network?
Well, Zachary, always on Facebook. That's where I'm most active, certainly around the Babel Conference. On Twitter, my Twitter handle is @CMichael1701. I'm also on Instagram, CMichael1701. We'd like to take a moment to acknowledge the rest of the Metatrex team from around the network. Specifically, we'd like to thank C. Brian Jones, founder and publisher of Trek FM. Our executive producers, Charlene Schmidt, Matthew Rushing, and Ken Tripp. Aaron Harvey, our art director, Richard Marquez, our production manager, and we want to give a special shout out to our two associate producers, Patrick Devlin. You can connect with Patrick on Twitter at MagicDrop5, and Kay Elizabeth Janeway. She's also on Twitter at ChocoWeeble. We really appreciate your support of MetaTrex and of the Trek FM network. We really couldn't do it without you guys. Thanks so much for being our associate producers. And thank you for listening to MetaTrex, a Star Trek philosophy podcast. Until next time, when we will once again boldly go where no philosophers have gone before.